The goal today will be to continue looking at this Torricode model in detail. So let's just again write the Hamiltonian. So you have two pieces, star term and a plaquette term, defined on qubits on edges of the square lattice. And the star term is just the product of Pauli Zs around every vertex. And this plaquette term is product of X's around every plaquette. Okay, so I think we ended last time with just explicitly enumerating the fourfold degenerate ground states. So this is a caricature of the energy spectrum. We have this fourfold degenerate ground state, and then we have a bunch of excited states, which we'll get to shortly. And this is also a gapped Hamiltonian with gap 4, as we'll also see shortly. Basically, excitations will come from some of these stabilizers not being 1, but minus 1. Okay. So, yes, yeah, so last time I emphasized that these four ground states are very special. They're locally indistinguishable. If you look at the local operator, they take the same expectation value no matter which ground state you're choosing. And furthermore, there's no local operator that can bring you from one state to another. Instead, you need some extended operator, like these string operators, to take you from one state to the other. So again, I think it's useful to compare that to the GHZ state we saw at the beginning. So recall that for GHZ states, we also have this twofold degeneracy. For this transistorializing model with no transverse field, it's just all the ZZ terms. So we again have a gap. We have twofold degeneracy. And here, there's no symmetric local operator. That takes you from one GHZ state to the other. However, there is, you know, non-symmetric local operator, in particular a local Z operator will take you from one GHZ to the other. And again, this is just all related to the fact that to define the symmetry breaking phase as a valid phase that's non-trivial, we demand that the Ising symmetry is there. Okay. Whereas for this Torricode or topological order case, there's no need to impose any symmetry. These statements about indistinguishability and lack of connectivity with local operator, they're all true for any local operators. Okay, so similar to the GHZ case, this property that it's hard for a local operator to connect the degenerate states, that implies, again, some kind of stability of this degeneracy to perturbation, right? So let's say I perturb this Torricode Hamiltonian by some local operator, say some poly z on every site, and I parameterize the strength of g. Then again, for small g, I could do degenerate perturbation theory on these four states. And what happens is that these four states are just split by some exponentially small amount, right? So basically, to connect the different states, I need to build up an operator that's precisely this Wilson loop operator, right? So I need basically g to the l. I need to go to lth order of degenerate perturbation theory to get a finite matrix element between these states. So this is the splitting in this fourfold degenerate subspace. Okay. So it's quite similar to the case of GHZ, where again, for small transverse field, it splits the exact degeneracy by some exponentially small amount, some amount that's especially small in system size. Okay, so yeah, so this suggests some robustness of topological order, in this case, toric code type order, to at least some window of perturbations, right? And indeed, one can imagine trying to work out the phase diagram for this model. So imagine we have some phase diagram parameterized by the strength g of this perturbation. So g equals 0, we have the ideal toric code. And this suggests that this toric code phase should persist up to some critical value gc. But of course, when g is very large, and then the toric code Hamiltonian is treated as a perturbation, then we want to satisfy this term. And this term just favors every spin pointing up. So for large g, we should be in some trivial phase. And I guess one useful picture to have in mind is that this perturbation is basically imposing some loop tension. Okay. So remember that we had this picture of these four ground states as a massive superposition of all loop configurations in the Z basis, right? And so these loops can be arbitrarily big, right? They all participate with equal weight in the superposition. However, once you impose this extra term in the Hamiltonian, then this is kind of favoring spins to be up and not down, right? So now the larger the loop, the more energetically unfavorable it is, right? So the more you crank up this term in the Hamiltonian, the more this is trying to confine the loops. It's trying to make smaller loops as opposed to bigger loops. Okay. So actually, this transition from toric code topological order to trivial order can be thought of as like a confinement transition. Okay. And much more can be said about this. However, just to, I guess, make contact with the beginning of the course where we found that duality can be a useful technique. Here, let me just point out that there's an interesting duality to a more familiar model. Okay. So, yeah, as you'll see, much of physics is just mapping a hard problem to another hard problem that at least you've seen before. So that's pretty much the power of duality. So let's use a similar transformation as the one we did for transserializing and see what this Hamiltonian gets mapped to. Okay, so our toric code Hamiltonian has qubits on the links of the square lattice. But now let's try to change perspective to some qubits living on the black heads, okay? On the centers of the black heads. So these will be denoted by open circles, okay? And let's make the identification that the qubit on the link between two of these black head qubits, let's define that this link qubit should serve as a domain wall variable for the two black head qubits. Okay, so for example, if these are both up, then this is up. However, if there's a domain wall between the black head qubits, then let's call this link qubit down. Okay, so I want to define new degrees of freedom on the black heads such that the original link qubits serve as domain walls for these new qubits. Okay. All right, so now let's see what.
I don't think I followed the discussion. How does it serve as a domain wall?
Yeah, so I'm just defining let's say I should probably specify the basis too. So all these are let's say in the Z basis. Okay, so all this up down are Z equals plus or minus one. And so I'm saying if the two black head qubits are aligned, then there's no domain wall, right? They're aligned. And no domain wall, I'm just denoting by this center one being up. Okay. But if there is a domain wall, then that's reflected in this link qubit being down. Okay. So this is a domain wall variable for the two black heads. Okay, so if you look at this star operator, remember the star operator was product of z's. Right? So now we see that this star operator corresponds to the product of domain wall variables for the links, right? That's the product of the z's, that's the product of the domain walls for the links. But now this product is automatically one when we define the model in these black head qubits, right? So, for the black head qubits, for any configuration of the black head qubits, the product of these domain walls is automatically one. Right. So if I, yeah, as you can see, if I have like say this configuration here, then this would be up, down, this would be up, and this would be down. Right? The product of the domain wall has to be one, just from the fact that it came from, just from the fact that it is a domain wall. Okay. So when I kind of shift variables to these black head qubits, this AS term does nothing. It's automatically enforced in this new description, right? So this AS automatically takes value one when I'm working using the Hilbert space of these black head qubits. And what about the black head? So the black head, I have product of x's. So this basically just says I want to flip all the domain walls around the new qubit, right? So in the new language, this basically just corresponds to the x operator on this new qubit. right? If I flip this Plaquette qubit, then I automatically flip all the domain walls around it, right? Domain wall becomes no domain wall, and vice versa. Okay. And then now, what does this perturbation correspond to? So, if I have this minus z on every side, well, this is probably the easiest. The z we just defined to be the domain wall, right? So this z is just the product of the z's on the two neighboring Plaquettes. Right. This is just a domain wall variable in terms of the new qubits. Okay, so now we see that this H prime Hamiltonian, when written in these new Plaquette degrees of freedom, is just just a simple paramagnetic term on every site. Again, we're dealing with sites of the dual lattice, so now on the Plaquettes now, right? And then also this ZZ, so strength G, and then nearest neighbor JK. Right, so we just identified all the terms in Tor code to new terms acting on these Plaquette qubits. And so this is nothing but transistorializing Hamiltonian again, right? But now in two dimensions, right? But again, it's pretty easy to convince yourself that like the 1D model for the 2D transistorializing model, there'll also be a transition between a ferromagnetic phase and a paramagnetic trivial phase. Now the phase transition is much more non-trivial. You can use a quantum classical mapping to map the universality class of this to 3Dizing, 3D classicalizing model. And yeah, I think you guys have already seen some quantum classical mapping in at the end of StatMech, so that hopefully be somewhat familiar. Yeah. So, anyways, long story short, this is one way in which this phase transition I just described can be understood using a dual set of variables. Yeah.
Could you repeat what you said about the confinement of the thing?
Yeah. So yeah. So yeah. I think much more can be said about that. It's just this is really serving as like a loop tension, right? Like it's saying I have a big superposition of loops, but now the bigger loops get penalized because of this term, right? So when I turn it large, I want to get a superposition of smaller loops, right? And then if it's too small, eventually it'll just look, it'll be trivial, it'll be, go to like a trivial product state. And this can all be quantified with like if you look at Wilson loop order parameter, yeah, like you can use similar techniques from classical gauge theory to diagnose this transition in the original set of variables. Like you can look at the Wilson loop scaling, and it goes from perimeter law to area law in the confined phase, et cetera.
Also, is there like the so when we did the mapping, the duality mapping 1D transistor,
Yeah.
we got this extra constraint
You got the right. Okay. So you're saying, yeah, I think, I may have to think more about this, but I think what he said is true for the other direction of like if you started out with this model first, and then you want to go back to the Tor code model, So this process is actually called gauging. Again, I don't want to go into too much detail, but I think what he said is true for going from here to the Tor code model, because then when you're going to the domain wall variable, you have this constraint, which is precisely this star term. Right. So basically, you're going from these Ising spins living on these empty circles to these solid circles, which are domain wall variables. And now when you go there, you have to impose a constraint on these, which is precisely the AS term. So the star term can be thought of as a constraint.
I was actually thinking of the Laplace term, because if you take the product of all the Laplace terms, you get identity.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's also true. Right. So I guess you will be working in one symmetry sector of this Ising model. That's a good point too. Okay, great. Okay, so now we will move on to characterizing the excitations of the Tor code. Like, what are these, what are these low-lying excited states with a finite gap above the ground state? So again, all these terms in the Hamiltonian commute, so excited states should be obtained by just these terms taking value not one but minus one, right? So naively, one might try to just set one star term to minus one, right? But again, recall that there is a global constraint on these constraints. So the product of all the stars is one, the product of all the plaquettes is one. So we cannot just flip one value, one star, from one to minus one. We have to flip at least a pair. Just like how in transitionalizing, you cannot just flip one ZZ to minus one, right? You have to flip at least a pair, right?
I think last lecture you mentioned that in that constraint, the product of all of them being one, that's where the topology is sort of hidden.
Indeed, that's true when I impose periodic boundary conditions. With open boundary conditions, it can get kind of subtle because there are different ways of terminating this model on an open boundary. Right. So indeed, in that case, in some cases, you actually can create a single excitation in the bulk, right? Maybe it'll be clearer once we actually explicitly see what the excitations are. But for now, let's just take periodic boundary conditions. Just as in the case of GHZ, we cannot create a single one. We need to create these in pairs. So let's try to see what these look like. For the case of GHZ, we saw that we can create ZZ excitations by just a local spin flip operator that creates a pair of domain walls, right? So I can again try to apply, say, some local spin flip on, say, a qubit here, right? So now if I flip this, okay, so sorry. So I'm imagining starting out with any one of the ground states of the Tor code, and then I'm applying some local flip, say, on this site. And now this new state will be an excited state, right? Because now when I apply a local flip here, now these two stabilizers will be minus one, right? Right, because now the product of z's will be minus one. I've flipped this qubit, or in other words, yeah, I need better notation. I think these two qubits, sorry, these two star terms anti-commute with the x operator. Okay, so. This excited state here now will cost energy 4, right? So each of these went from 1 to minus 1, and I have 2 of them. So this excited state has energy 4. And this is not this is clearly not a unique excited state. I can apply a whole string of x's. If I apply, for example, more x's here, then you can see that the endpoints of the string cost energy, right? So the stars at the endpoints of the strings take value minus one, but everything in the middle still looks fine, right? So for example, if I take a star here or a star here, then I have product of x's, right? So I've even number of flips, two flips, and that commutes with the star operator, right? So the bulk of the string commutes with all the terms in the Hamiltonian, so it doesn't cost any energy. It's only the endpoints that don't commute with the Hamiltonian. So it's the endpoints that cost energy. Okay. This is very similar to the case of the 1D transitalizing, where with a line of spin flip operators, I can create two domain walls at the endpoints, but everything in between is invisible to the Hamiltonian. It just commutes with the Hamiltonian. Okay, so again, it'll be fruitful to think of these endpoints as deconfined particles. And these are sometimes called E particles or electric charges.
So what is the endpoint here? Didn't we say we're using periodic boundary conditions?
Yeah. So here, the whole Hamiltonian is defined, say, with periodic boundary conditions. Now I'm just applying a string operator in part of the bulk, and the string operator can be like any shape you want. You can deform it however you like, and the bulk doesn't cost any energy. It all commutes with the Hamiltonian, but the endpoints cost some energy.
And you said that any string that I have, I still have the same gap.
Yeah, that's right. Any configuration of this open string, it just costs energy, the same energy, no matter how long or short it is. Right. Yeah, and just to be clear, now I'm returning back to the ideal Torah code model without any perturbation. Keep it simple. Okay, so that's one set of excitations that live on the vertices. Those would be what we call the E particles or charges. And then the Blackett excitations are obtained in a similar fashion. So now if I want to flip a Blackett B term from plus one to minus one, I can do that by applying a local Z operator. And now, when I apply a z operator on the ground state, now that will frustrate these two product of x placards. Right. So now this BP here will be minus 1. This BP here will be minus 1. Again, because z anti-commutes with the product of x's here. Okay, so this will cost energy 4. And just like before, if I now consider a product of z's, like z here, z here, then I will incur energy costs at the endpoints of the string again. So this BP is minus 1, this BP here is minus 1. But in the middle of the string, I have an even number of z's again, which commutes with the product of x's in between. So the middle of the string again costs no energy, and again is invisible, right? So basically I have these excitations created by strings on the dual lattice with that cost energy at their endpoints. Okay, so again, I should view these endpoints as some quasi-particle-like excitations. So these are called M particles, or also magnetic fluxes. Okay, so these are all the low-lying excitations of the Torr code model. And so now the very interesting thing is that there's actually non-trivial particle statistics between these two types of particles. Okay, so first, I guess it's not too hard to convince yourself that the E and the M the E and M are individually bosons. I'm referring to the self statistics. Right, so if I try to if I create a pair of E particles and I move them around each other, then I'm always using string operators made out of X's, and those commute with each other. So if I move E's around each other or M's around each other, then they have no non-trivial statistics. They're just bosons, ordinary bosons. However, what's non-trivial is when I try to move E and M around each other, right? And you can already get a hint of that just from the fact that these strings, which can be used to move these particles around, they don't commute, right? One is built from X's, one is built from Z's. Okay, so but let's see this more carefully. So we'll want to consider a procedure where we braid an E particle around an M particle. So let's start with a configuration I'll call EM that involves basically a magnetic particle of this type here. And then there might be some partner magnetic particle, you know, somewhere far away. We don't care about that one. So anyways, there's some string that connects this magnetic particle to some partner far away. Okay. And similarly, let's start with an E particle here, which again must have some partner somewhere else. Let's say far away here. Okay, so this state here is what I'll call the reference state EM. Okay. And now I want to move this E particle around the M particle and see what it does to this state. Okay, so I want to move the E particle, say this way. I want to move it in this loop around encircling this M particle and see what it does to the state. So I can move this E particle around by just applying this string operator. Remember that the string operator is basically invisible. It incurs no energy cost. So I can use it to move this E particle around. Okay, so basically this motion can be realized by applying a product of X operators in this loop. Okay, so let me define this loop as UX. Okay. And it turns out, and I can explain this in more detail, it turns out that applying this UX to this original configuration actually produces a minus sign. Okay. So there are two ways to see this. One way is just to see that this UX is the product of Plaquette operators within this loop. So basically, the product of these four Plaquettes. Basically, it's the total magnetic flux inside this loop, right? And so since I had a non-trivial flux excitation here, the total flux in here is minus one, right? Right, this one was 1, 1, 1, and minus one here. Okay. Yeah, one can see it in one can see this in several different ways. So yeah, for example, one other way of seeing this is to just expand out the EM reference configuration in terms of the Torah code. Right. So this EM is obtained by applying these string operators on Torah code, UM and UE. On a Torah code ground state, right? That's what this reference configuration is defined as, right? So now to look at the effect of this braiding process on this EM configuration, and that's just this product of X here applied to UM UE acting on Torah code ground state. And so this UM was a string of Z operators connecting M to some faraway point. And this string involves a Z here, right? Involves a Z here. And so this Z will anti-commute with this one of the X's from the braiding, right? So basically I get minus UM Liberating X, UE, Grand State. And then now the braiding X commutes with the electric string, which is made out of X's, right? So this just equals minus UM UE, product of X's on Grand State. And product of X's on Grand State acts trivially because because it's just a product of the Plaquette operators, which are all taking value one. Okay, so basically this acts as identity on the Grand State. So indeed, I get this important phase factor of minus one.
So
yeah.
Repeat the last thing again. I remember last time we spoke about these string operators that we can use to distinguish between ground states. Now you're saying that it's the identity?
That's right, that's right. So the string operators that can be used to distinguish ground states or connect them involve non-contractible cycles around the torus. So they wrap around a cycle of the torus. Whereas for any ground state, any contractible loop always takes value one in the ground state because it's made out of a product of the Plaquette stabilizers, which are all one for the ground state. Yeah. Okay, so what's the significance of this factor minus one? Well, it's helpful to see what we've done in a space-time picture. So basically, the starting configuration EM here involves E and M particles just sitting there or propagating trivially in time, right? However, what we've done with this by applying the string operator is basically to the M particle in the middle of the loop is just sitting there, it's doing nothing. However, we're taking this E particle, and using the string to move it around the M particle, right? So that looks like this braiding process. This is the E particle that we've used a string to move it around the M. Okay. And we've seen that this gives a factor of minus one relative to the trivial trajectory of them. Okay? So this minus one is very non-trivial, right? So this procedure of moving the E around the M is basically a double exchange, right? So the E going this way would be one exchange, right? Switching E and M, that would be one exchange. But then we move it back again around, and so that's a double exchange. So from a double exchange process, we get a factor of minus one. So even for fermions, this is not possible, right? If I take two fermions, I exchange them once, I get a factor of minus one. Then if I exchange them again, I get a factor of plus one, right? But now here with a double exchange, I get a factor of minus one. So this EN actually have mutual, what's called mutual semionic statistics. Like basically a single exchange will give you a phase factor of I, right? Okay, so we've seen that these E and M are individually bosons relative to themselves, but relative to each other, they have these non-trivial particle statistics. Okay. And so one further consequence of this is that now let's consider what happens when we kind of combine E and M particle together. Okay. So let's take a pair of EM particles, okay, and another pair of EM particles here. And now let's try to exchange these pairs of particles. So I can move this pair this way, and then I can move this pair this way. So now we can first try to simplify this procedure. So here I have an E going here, an E going here. E and E are mutual bosons, right? So I can just resolve this, right? So I can just resolve this crossing since they're mutual bosons. And similarly, I can resolve this pair of M's since they're also mutual bosons. So I have E, M, E, M. Yeah, so I've just resolved the bosonic part of this braiding. But then now I have this M and E that are undergoing a double exchange. Right, so that means that this equals minus one relative to E, M, E, M. Yeah, maybe, sorry, I think I should have been more careful with what's going over the other one, right? So let's see. Let's say this one is going under. Yeah, so then this should be going under. So this M goes over here, and then it goes under here. Yeah, so this ME process is precisely a double exchange. Okay, so we see that when we exchange this pair of EM composite particles, when we exchange them, we get a minus sign relative to not exchanging them, right? So this means that this EM particle, this pair of EM particles, is actually a fermion with respect to itself, right? The self-statistics of this pair is a fermion. And this is called a F particle. Okay, so this is one of the really, I think, amazing features of topological order. We start out with a model of interacting bosonic degrees of freedom, these spins, right, these qubits, and somehow there are these emergent excitations that can be fermions, they can have mutual semion statistics. I think it's one of the really amazing things about emergence and many body physics. Right? Any questions about this?
So I should understand that you said the fermion, I sort of like flip it and I get a minus sign.
Yeah, so here.
Exactly what happens there, right?
Yeah, so here we're trying to exchange the pair,
right.
Just one exchange for this pair. And we see that we incur minus sign relative to not exchanging. And this is derived using the EM mutual statistics.
Can you quickly just explain how you got from the first one to the second diagram?
First one to the second one. Yeah.
How does E go to
Right. So basically, so first we want to simplify this EE crossing. EE crossing, they have no non-trivial statistics, so that one we can just resolve, right?
By resolve, you mean I
By
can
resolve, I just mean there's no, like, the crossing is the same as them just
just go.
going off independently, right? And similarly for this crossing here, for the M and M, right? There's nothing non-trivial there, just the same as them propagating without crossing, right? But then it's these two crossings that are non-trivial. That's the E and M mutual statistics, right? Yeah.
When you say convergence,
Yeah.
usually I think of that with system size. So is this just like the interactions, or like what is the thing that, like, I understand what you mean, but it's kind of different from the normal feature.
Yeah, it's true. So I think ultimately we again rely on taking the thermodynamic limit. Here it's not very manifest because we're taking a idealized Torr code model with zero correlation length that's exactly solvable. So all this physics can be seen exactly even for a very small system size, right? But again, you want to define, a phenomenon, not just for a particular model, but for an entire phase, right? And so when you do that, when you consider a generic model, when you perturb away from the fixed point, then you'll have some finite correlation length, right? And so now all these strings will be dressed by some correlation length, right? And now the key is that this dressing is by some constant correlation length that does not scale with the system size, right? So even when we take the limit as L goes to infinity, right, these string operators are of finite width, right? And so that's the universality of these immersion particles, right? Yeah. Yeah, but it's true, for a finite system size, people are trying to build a Torr code with only so many qubits. And they're, it's zero correlation length, so you can see these statistics already. I think people have already carried out some of these experiments. Yeah. Okay, so, yeah.
I've heard that these exotic statistics only happen in two spatial dimensions.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, basically in 3D, if you like in 3 or higher D, I think, if you try to, let's see. Yeah, if you try to picture these like space-time processes, then you find that this double exchange process always can be deformed into a trivial world lines. Okay. Yeah, I'm not sure I can. There's some nice mathematics behind that you can be very rigorous about it. I'm not sure I can picture that myself, but yeah, in 3D, if you try to picture, three space dimension propagating in time, and you try to do this double exchange, you can see that you can always continuously deform that into trivial, which means that all double exchanges are one, right? Which says that it can be fermion or boson, right? But yeah, maybe I can try to dig up some resource for that if you're interested. Okay, so I think the last thing I want to mention is it's just again returning to this theme of phases of matter. Here I've argued that there is a phase transition in 3D classicalizing universality class. But again, we would like to see more, maybe more from a complexity of wave function point of view, why Tor code and trivial are distinct phases, right? So this is already, I think at a physical level, it's quite clear. You have this fourfold degeneracy that's becoming one-fold degeneracy. You have these non-trivial anion excitations that are disappearing. So I think I think a physicist would be quite content with understanding this as a phase transition, but again, in a more modern understanding of quantum phases, we want to see that it's actually hard to go from a trivial state to a topologically ordered state with simple operations, namely with a finite depth circuit or with a finite time evolution with a local Hamiltonian, right? So remember that we went through the same exercise with the GHZ type states in transistorializing. We saw that it's hard to go from trivial paramagnet to GHZ state due to this long range correlation of this long range connected ZZ correlators, right? So we saw that the Lieb-Robinson bound forbids one from generating these ZZ long range correlations required for the GHZ state, right? So in that sense, GHZ trivial are two distinct phases of matter. And now we want to see the same is true for topological order, okay? And this is slightly more non-trivial because, like I said before, topological order doesn't have these long-range connected correlators of local operators, right? So how can we see some obstruction? So it turns out that this Lieb-Robinson bound basically the Lieb-Robinson bound is still relevant in forbidding going from trivial to topological order with a simple circuit. So the statement is that topological order ground states cannot be prepared with let's say a finite depth quantum circuit or let's say finite time local Hamiltonian evolution from a trivial product state. So this is more of a quantum information theoretic way of proving or saying that topological order is in a distinct phase of matter. Okay, so I'll just, for simplicity, let me just focus on finite depth quantum circuit as a caricature of finite time local Hamiltonian evolution. So yeah, so I think all of you have seen like a quantum circuit by now somewhere. Just imagine you apply these local unitary gates, and you have some finite depth circuit. So let's call such a finite depth circuit U. So let's assume that one could prepare topological order ground state. Okay. So assume for contradiction. Let me just emphasize that it's local. Assume for contradiction that one can prepare psi topological order from a trivial state. And let's say that trivial state is just all up. Okay. All up product state. Okay, but this is where the key property that we said last time of local indistinguishability plays an important role. So recall that for psi top one and for psi top two, So any pair of states that are topologically ordered, any pair of states in the degenerate manifold, any local operator cannot distinguish them, right? So if we're assuming that, say, one of these topologically ordered states could be prepared with a finite-depth circuit, then this leads to contradiction because this state, this reference all up state, is completely specified by all Zi operators taking value plus one, right? And so this means that the psi topological order one state is completely specified by conjugating these Z operators. And enforcing that all these dressed operators take value plus one. Okay? Okay, but if psi topological order one is completely specified by this, then that means that this partner topologically ordered state, psi two, which has the exact same local operator expectation values, must also be completely specified. So this would mean that psi topological order one is actually identical to psi topological order two, up to some phase factor. Okay, so again, the key here is that these two states are identical with respect to local operators. That's one important property. The other important property is that here we're assuming that a finite-depth circuit, a local circuit, can transform product state to topological order. And the finite-depth circuit can only dress the local operator so much. It just blows up local Z into some operator that's still supported in some finite region. So those are the two key aspects of this proof here. So by contradiction, this cannot be possible. Okay. So we need a deep circuit. Turns out a circuit of depth at least order system size to transform a trivial state into a topologically ordered state. Okay. And so this can be generalized to from the finite depth quantum circuit to a finite time local Hamiltonian evolution by using Lieb-Robinson bounds. Okay. But yeah, I think this assuming finite depth local circuit just makes it much more clear. Yeah.
Can you use a similar argument to argue the same thing for open boundary conditions?
Open boundary condition.
Degeneracy.
Well, okay, so maybe okay, so I guess there is a choice of open boundary condition in which you don't have degeneracy, right? Or you could also consider this model defined on like a sphere too. Yeah, so if you don't have this degeneracy, this argument breaks down. And so then you need more powerful methods. But it remains true that you cannot connect them even with a unique ground state on certain manifolds. But that's beyond the scope of this, yeah. Yeah, there are other techniques that can be used to also arrive at contradictions for this. Yeah.
How does it break down? Is it the fact that there's no side to?
Yeah. So here I relied on there being at least two states with this property, right? Yeah. Okay, so indeed, topological order is a genuinely distinct phase of matter, which is why it requires a singularity of phase transition to go from non-trivial to trivial. So that's all I want to say. So unfortunately, I didn't get to entanglement, but maybe for the tutorial we can touch on that. Yeah, any other questions?
Why are the E and M particles called electric?
Yeah, okay, that's another good question. It basically comes from U1 gauge theory. Basically almost like our ordinary electromagnetism, but in two dimensions. So there, this Z2 is like a subgroup of U1, right? The short story is it comes from U1 gauge theory, and I think it's a nice there's a nice explanation of like the relation between Z2 U1 gauge theories in either I think John McGreevy has a nice set of lecture notes online for that. That when you move a charge around a magnetic flux, you can get Aronov-Bohm phase. That's ultimately the origin of these names. Yeah. Okay, so I think the plan next time on Thursday will be to cover some basic SPT, or symmetry-productive topological physics. Yeah.